applaud the organizers for taking up such a big topic. And we're charged with talking about it in a pretty short time, and I want to thank Dr. Danziger by setting the stage by talking about the escalating rates of inequality. When I told my senior team that I was going to be coming here to talk about social justice and STD prevention, they said, well, gosh, you talk about that on any single topic. And that's true. We can apply this lens to all that we do, and I want to thank all of you for applying it to your work in STD prevention and control. When I started thinking about what I would talk about, I thought one of the things I wanted to start out with is saying that we need to realize what an outlier the United States is. Now, we may all see it on television these days, but we need to understand it also from the point of view of our data. And I went looking for some slides that showed STD occurrence in the United States versus Europe, versus our peer nations in terms of high-income nations. And I found this slide sort of embarrassingly for the young man who was helping me put my slides together. It was put together by something called OnlineDocSuperDrugs.com. But it's based on CDC and WHO data, and I have no reason not to think that it's not accurate. And I, for those of you from the CDC, I don't know why it's so hard to find these data and why it's being provided by a .com. But what you can see here is that the U.S. has an outsized STD problem. This is escalating rates of chlamydia, even though gonorrhea rates, which we now know are threatened by the emergence of drug resistance, have leveled and come down. They're way higher than what we're seeing in comparable wealthy nations. Now, when people talk about the poor performance of the U.S. on any number of health indicators compared to other wealthy nations, they always mention the fact that we are diverse, that there are these subgroups, which is really code language for the African American population, by and large, that have just unremitting health problems. And that's what accounts for the miserable health statistics, our high infant mortality rate, the problems that we have with any number of disparities. And so I just wanted, I can't break these down by race, but I will be breaking down New York City's rates by race later. And we do know that African Americans and other marginalized groups have higher rates, LGBTQ, rural populations. But I want us to remember that we suffer as a country from too many adverse health outcomes. And the Institute of Medicine did an analysis, and this slide, it takes a little bit, and I'm going to take a moment to explain it to you, that showed how non-Hispanic whites, which we in everyday language refer to as white people, compared to 17 peer countries in terms of mortality rates. And these are basically Western Europe and Australia. These are the 17 countries, and this is the U.S., down at the bottom. The only time that we see rates begin to increase is in late life. That's not when we want our life expectancy to go up. We want it to be high here at the start of life. And this is for whites. So it's really important for us to understand that the costs that we're paying in terms of enduring divisions by race in our society, escalating income inequality, which disproportionately affects racial minority groups, is paid by all of us. It's paid also by the white population, which, as you can see, is also burdened by higher than expected mortality rates given our wealth as a nation and the amount that we spent on health care, which exceeds by far any other wealthy nation. So the whole issue of talking about race and the role of race in affecting our health really has been brought to the fore, not by those of us who work in public health, but by most recently a movement that goes under the tagline hashtag Black Lives Matter. This slide, which was taken from their website, gives some data which I think should give us all pause, particularly this, something that I never knew. 35 is the average life expectancy for a black transgender woman. Now, the Black Lives Matter movement, because I think that it really is a movement, got its start with the death of Trayvon Martin, a young man who died at the hands, not of police, but of a volunteer security worker. They really take care to frame violence as more broad a phenomenon than deaths at the hands of police. Although I would want to bring to this audience's attention that if you want to find out about deaths at the hands of the police, you also can't find that out at a CDC website. You or at a New York City Health Department or any U.S. website, the best place is the Guardian newspaper, a British newspaper, which has continued to monitor deaths at the hands of legal intervention. It's unfortunately on target this year to be about the same as it was last year. But the Black Lives Matter movement framed violence as a broader phenomenon than simply police violence. That's why they were highlighting the life expectancy of black women in poverty and of transgender women. I took heart with the hashtag Black Lives Matter challenge to those of us in medicine and in public health, and wrote a piece that was, I thought, sort of surprisingly published by the New England Journal of Medicine, which I think we can all agree is a rather conservative medical journal. And I made the point that I want to make again today, that we in public health have important contributions to make to raising this debate and this discussion in our work. We can do research. We can look at our own organizations and see how our own makeup in terms of who our students are, who our staff and faculty are, who the members of my own department are, what its leadership looks like, and additionally speaking out about race. And in doing this, I've found that it's really important to remind people of the history of this country. And surprisingly, I think, many people just don't realize how embedded in the history of this country is the its foundational reliance on an enslaved workforce. We just heard a lot of really important information about escalating income inequality, but we didn't frame it at all with respect, Dr. Danziger, you may want to speak to it later, in terms of the divisions of our population by race. So the period in which Africans were enslaved in this country went on for over 300 years and only ended with the Civil War and a period which is known as Reconstruction, which lasted for just over 20 years when the period of Reconstruction came to an end and the Jim Crow period, which which restored racial segregation in the American South, and also resulted in a return to the violent treatment of the black population, particularly with the phenomenon of mass lynchings. You may know that the number of lynchings has been recently revisited and was certainly much higher than had appeared on the public record. I was lucky enough to come of age during the Civil Rights period, which began in the mid-1960s with a whole host of progressive legislation and effectively ended in 1980. And when we saw a beginning of the reversal of that progressive era, a rise of mass incarceration and the disproportionate experience of police violence, this is another way of saying the same thing with a graphic, and this is the arc of the black experience in the United States I think green is supposed to mean it's a lot better, and it is. There's no doubt that I am very grateful that I was born around here and not around here. But nonetheless, I think it's important to note that this period here, the civil rights era, which ended with the election of Ronald Reagan, was really the period in which the most substantive change occurred, and we've seen an attack on those advances ever since. Now, in New York City, this has played out in the phenomenon of segregation. New York City, by some measures, is the third most segregated city in the United States, in addition to having very high levels of income inequality. About half of the New York City population lives in or near poverty. Now, I'm just going to, I know I'm probably already running behind schedule, but I just want to point out to you that this uses something called the Black-White Dissimilarity Index. Anything that is higher than 0.6 is considered high, meaning that blacks and whites are spatially segregated. In New York City, this number is about 83, which means that 83% of the black population or the white population would have to move to achieve a balanced dispersal in our city. And these are the neighborhoods that even those of you who don't live in New York will be familiar with, East and Central Harlem, the South Bronx, Central Brooklyn. And of course, it parallels other social determinants. The same neighborhoods repeatedly light up, and all you need to know about these maps is that the darker the color, the higher the burden. By any number of measures, being absent from elementary school, which is a measure both of school quality and of family cohesion, the incarceration rate, the unemployment rate, the poverty rate. In New York City, poverty and race track very closely, so that to be poor is basically to be black or Latino, and to be black or Latino is basically to be poor. Of course, this isn't strictly true one-on-one. And these also track with health. And here, the point that I always make about this slide is that these are very different outcomes. This is asthma. This is HIV. This is overdose, drug-related hospitalizations. This is diabetes. All conditions that have a very different pathway. They're not biologically similar. And yet the very same neighborhoods light up again and again. If we needed any evidence that the occurrence of these conditions is related to structural factors, I think that this is really all that I need. There's something structural in the vulnerability of these communities to ill health. And it's also, although we often look at what we call chronic diseases, diseases that we think somehow are connected to personal choice in the way that being employed is supposedly a personal choice. This variation by high poverty, mostly black and Latino neighborhoods, is also true for many communicable diseases. And this slide shows 21 infectious diseases that we identified in New York City that were more likely to occur in a high poverty neighborhood than in a low poverty neighborhood. There are a handful of conditions that happen more often in wealthy neighborhoods. Tick-borne illnesses, I guess, related to who gets to go to Connecticut for holidays. But you can see that the things that you all spend a lot of your time thinking about have a very, very strong relationship to poverty. This is gonorrhea, chlamydia, HIV/AIDS, syphilis. I assume that there are a lot of epidemiologists in the crowd. This means that there's no relationship. This means that the rate ratio, meaning that you're threefold more likely to have these conditions if you live in a high poverty neighborhood than if you live in a low poverty neighborhood. And all of these conditions are above the line here. And, of course, you can see this visually plotted out by neighborhood. Although we do have, this is Chelsea, a neighborhood which has been a focal point for MSMs in the city. This is a neighborhood that has long been a gay-friendly neighborhood. But you can see, in addition, that the same neighborhoods that I highlighted with other diseases, this is syphilis, this is chlamydia, gonorrhea has a much broader distribution across the city. That's gonorrhea in men. And here you see what we expect to see. The breakdown of chlamydia case rates by race. This is blacks. This is white, non-Hispanic whites. These are Latinos. Much higher rates in people of African American descent. So this means that you're both that we should think of these as both having higher exposure, being more likely to acquire infection, and also more likely to fail to get adequate treatment for infection. This is gonorrhea, a similar kind of pattern. And I think, and you can see here that our gonorrhea rates were going up, that our chlamydia rates have began to tick up, and that's related to this headline here. We in New York City have the luxury of having a very well-funded health department. And I have the luxury of having many wonderful staff who work on the areas of sexually transmitted infections. You'll have the opportunity to hear from Dr. Blank, who gave me my very kind introduction, about some of the things that we have in mind. I know the head of our HIV bureau is somewhere here in the room. But we face budget cuts like everyone else, and our services are very frequently the first casualties of major budget cuts. And we had rounds and rounds of budget cuts that resulted in the reduction of services, the closure of clinic hours, of clinics, and the reduction of clinic hours in settings that remained open. Here you see a headline, City STD Clinics to Close Mondays to cut costs amid a meningitis outbreak that was tied to the MSM community. We are grateful, I'm very grateful, that we are in a political environment now in New York City under the de Blasio administration, and also, although they don't always get along, they often don't get along, with the leadership of the governor of New York State. On this, they have been in complete alignment and retooling our strategy to see an end of HIV, an opportunity that we've had now to greatly improve equity in sexual health across the city by reinvigorating our STD clinics, reimagining them as sexual health clinics, and so we have a hopeful prospect ahead of us that by focusing on these neighborhoods, because that's one thing that segregation does achieve, it allows us to geographically target our services, we will be able to return services to communities that trust us and also appreciate having easy access facilities. So these are the things that we're doing now. We are renovating these updated clinics. We all even had some people go visit, I'm going to forget the name of it, I think it's a Dean Street clinic in London, a great clinic. And we can't quite do that, but we are improving our facilities in terms of expanding their hours of operation, and the returning them to everyday service, including Saturday service, returning the ability to do testing for asymptomatic individuals who want to get checked out. And we have really restored, I'd say, and rebuilt our relationship with the advocate community, involving them in innovative campaigns that we hope will begin to bring people back into our clinics as we restore them. I really have been proud to be part of an effort that's seen advocates and the health department, which were frequently at loggerheads, begin to work as partners as we move forward on restoring sexual health and addressing sexual health equity across the city. These on the slide, you'll see a couple of the specific activities that we have been engaged in. Also, because New York City really considers itself a city-state, I would say. We're big. Our population is 8.5 billion. I just want to, just for all of you, since I have the mic and the opportunity to speak to all of you, to say that these are some, on this list, are some things that we shouldn't give up on, that we continue to place on our federal and state legislative agenda. We need more Title X funding. There are still a couple dozen states that could be expanding Medicaid to make a real pitch for the importance of preserving our public STD clinics, even as we expand insurance coverage through the Affordable Care Act. And in New York City, we've seen a 30% reduction in the number of uninsured in our city. Our public clinics play an indisputable role in providing access to communities for treatment. We need to continue to advocate for sex education. Just last year, for the first time after over, it's more than a decade of advocacy, we got the ability to have condom demonstrations in classrooms. So just in progressive New York City, we were not able to do that until quite recently. We, of course, in an era of electronic records, have to figure out how to both exchange and protect patient information. We need, and this is something we've put on our agenda with the state, to figure out how to continue to expand expedited partner therapy. And we've had very good luck in New York City with using private funds to try innovative ideas. So I want to just leave you with the fact that the high rates of STDs that we see in our country, we should consider have to do with the social context that both Dr. Danziger and I have outlined, that these are not inevitable. Peer nations do not experience these sorts of rates, nor should we blame them on the individuals who are showing up at our clinic doors with infections that need to be diagnosed and treated. And further, that the high rates that we continue to see in the African-American population need to be both acknowledged, and the potential role of racism in our healthcare delivery system, even within our broader society, in terms of the shame that people feel in seeking treatment, has to be considered. We should not consider this an inevitable consequence of the demographic diversity of our country, and I certainly don't consider it a consequence, inevitably, of the demographic diversity of New York City. Thanks very much.
I'd like to open up the mics to questions. Make sure that if you do have any questions or comments you'd like to share, that you keep them direct, brief, and that you use the mics, identify yourselves, and where you're from. Yes, sir.
Hi, Daniel from Vermont. Fine presentations all around. Love the theme of social justice or inequities. I would like to address the question, I love seeing it on the list, EPT. And I'm curious, especially with the latest treatment guidelines and fear of resistant gonorrhea, when we look at treating gonorrhea and the medication right now being ceftriaxone or rocephin, it seems to me that cefixime could be a way to address individuals that aren't getting treated at all. But also, is that a social injustice if we are treating with cefixime or an inferior treatment regimen as long as it's ensuring treatment? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. I'm going to have to defer to Dr. Blank on this, who directs our STDs. What I can tell you is that for us it's been an issue because the state has now adopted electronic prescribing. So all prescriptions in New York City are done through electronic prescribing. So we want to advocate to the state that we still be able to do, that we get carved out EPT from electronic prescribing. So that's been the advocacy position that I can speak to, but in terms of antibiotics, I think I'm going to have to defer to Dr. Blank here.
So just so that you know, we worked very hard to get that EPT law passed in New York State. It only covers the treatment of chlamydia. So in fact, we're concerned about emerging antibiotic resistance as well. We have debated for years about whether we should include gonorrhea, but at least this way we can assure that the treatment that's recommended is universal without the benefit of EPT. So that sort of not answers your question, but sort of answers your question.
Two not answered questions and responses.
Is there someone over there?
Dr. Marion Johansson, Guy's and St. Thomas's Hospital in London. I've got a question for Dr. Bassett. Thank you for that presentation and the striking the hypersegmentation you were showing for New York City. I was wondering, does that correlate also that hypersegmentation with provision of services? And are there any ways to get around that if it is the case?
Well, that's a really interesting question, and it varies. The main barrier right now to having health insurance in New York City that we haven't really figured out how to address is being undocumented, because the undocumented population was cut out of the Affordable Care Act as part of the political compromise that was necessary to getting it passed. So in some communities, like Harlem, for example, which is still a predominantly African-American community, the insurance rates are high. The insurance coverage rates are high. So in theory, access to care should be available to people. But I would say that there are harder-to-measure concerns about quality of care. That's part of the reason that I feel so strongly about the preservation of public STD clinics, where we can be confident in the quality of care that we provide and at the low barrier access that they offer. And as you'll hear in other presentations in this meeting, we're moving on to innovative strategies in these settings using PEP, PrEP, and even Quick Start on ART. Within our public STD clinics, we think that those will have equity-promoting effects.
And are you considering online testing as well to support that?
We hadn't. Dr. Blank, have we considered that?
We had at one point, but we are not currently considering that. But that doesn't mean it's off the table. If you come Friday morning, we'll be talking about some of the implementation and some of the challenges and successes that we faced. So I'll table that discussion. I will not answer another question.
Thank you.
For people who are undocumented, something like 3/4 of them in a pilot that we're doing trying to improve care access for the undocumented, something like 3/4 report that they think that their health care is terrible. That's their own view of their health care.
Okay. Next.
Hi, Dan Wolfeiler, California. Thank you both for your talks. We've struggled a lot in our field about figuring out how do we address the actual causes that you both have talked about. We've got some understanding of what kind of services and how to target those services, but I'm wondering if you have some favorite examples of how STDs and to some extent HIV, which has been a little more successful, how our fields can either weigh in with data or with our programmatic experience to try and affect some of the dynamics you're talking about, whether it's incarceration or housing or poverty or education, besides all of us going home and voting, which I certainly hope we will all do.
Well, I want to first make a plug for advocacy and for continuing to frame our remarks in the context of seeing our role as promoting anti-racist institutions. So just because we can't solve problems doesn't mean that we shouldn't accurately name them. So I think that to the extent that you're doing that, I would say keep it up. You don't have to have the answer in order to point out problems. But what I can say we've been doing in New York City, one that I didn't talk much about, is greatly improving our community involvement and trying to transform ourselves from an institution that uses the word involvement to one that talks about engagement. Because in many African-American communities, I can speak to because that's the community that I come from, there are many barriers to care seeking that have to do with stigma around sexually transmitted infections. And those we need to address by engaging more closely with communities. We need to turn our clinics into places that are welcoming and not stigmatizing, that are respectful. We often don't realize the extent to which our front desks turn people off and make people feel ashamed. And, of course, we need to be attentive to cost, that people need to be we're really proud of the tradition our clinics have had, that you can walk in and get services without somebody first making sure that you can pay for them. So all of those, and then, of course, in New York City, we have clinics located in neighborhoods which serve the population and have the highest disease burden. So those are the very same clinics now that we're seeking to sort of, build up, expand their hours, expand the days that they're open, and make them more inviting and the services better known to the surrounding community. Do you want to add to that, Dr. Danziger?
No.
Okay.
Thank you both.
I was trying to go.
Oh, there you
lefty
are.
Lefty-righty. But please continue.
Okay. I'm Valerie Coachman Moore, and thank you all of you for your presentation. I'm from We Can Stop STDs LA, Los Angeles, a community engagement model that we'd like to think has some really good roots. When you talk about social justice, of course, a lot of the work and the war on poverty, all of that is a lot of times driven by grassroots initiatives, people in the streets, people in communities, people on farms moving forward. So you just now, Dr. Barrett, talked about, Bassett, mentioned some of the community engagement efforts there in New York City, and I just thank you for that, and if there's any more that you'd like to expand upon, either of you, it would be really helpful.
So I think a surprise to many people has been the success at local areas of raising the minimum wage when the federal government hasn't done anything since 1997, so I see the analogy there. Then, of course, when a group of politicians say we always believe in local control, they believe in local control until local areas try to raise the minimum wage, and so then they pass state laws saying localities can't increase the minimum wage. So we've also seen a backlash. But I think most economists are shocked at the success of the Fight for 15, which was clearly an advocacy movement. So that's the analogy I can think of in the sort of economic arena.
Let's see. Well, when I became commissioner, one of the things that I said that I really wanted to do was change the way in which we work with communities. I was part of the Bloomberg administration, which preceded the de Blasio administration, and we really did a great job, I thought, in wielding the tools of government, meaning using legislation, taxation, policy approaches to promote health. But what we hadn't done as well was ensuring that the populations that we were seeking to help understood what we were doing and why, and had a meaningful opportunity to tell us whether what we were proposing made sense to them or not. So I've just approved a policy for the agency. It hasn't even been announced yet, so you guys are getting to hear about it first, in which we ask ourselves always when we embark on an activity, should there be community engagement in this activity? And if not, why not? And so the default should be that we will begin to work in you know, in a range of ways, because after all, this is our job. We're paid to do this. We shouldn't expect communities to do the same amount of work that we do. But I would say that it's been working successfully in a number of ways. For example, I just refer you to something that was published in the American Journal of Public Health on work that we did on reproductive justice and a campaign to promote long-acting contraception that was really modified by our engagement with a whole host of community-based organizations. I also want to note that, of course, I work for an administration and in a state where the minimum wage of $15 has been supported by the political structure. So whoever said we should all vote, I want to echo that. We should all vote. And I also want to point out, though, that our mayor, who won with 75% of the vote, was unable to successfully negotiate that a tax on people who make more than $1 million a year should pay for our pre-K program. So, and that was not for, you know, that was for people with an income of $1 million or more a year, but he was unable to get it through politically, so.
We are running over. Yeah. We're going to take one more question, and then afterwards, for those of you who'd still like to ask your questions, come forward. You, sir, up there.
Hello. My name is Mike Jeppes, and I'm a health navigator over at Fenway Health in Boston. Thank you both for very excellent presentations. Something I've noticed is when we talk about addressing health disparities, we often focus about the acute clinical setting. And Dr. Bassett, I was wondering if you specifically could talk about how you address health disparities in New York City outside of the healthcare facility context. Think about like transportation reimbursement programs, childcare, other services that are created to assist those most marginalized in getting to that clinical setting in the first place.
Hmm. I think some people refer to this as health in all policies. Mm-hmm. And my experience so far as commissioner has been that other agencies don't take too kindly to the idea that they work for me, kind of. So we've actually not framed it that way. And we've tried to participate in other people's processes. For example, there's a whole neighborhood planning activity going on about affordable housing, and the health department staff attend that. And we talk about the things you're talking about. But I absolutely agree that these have a bearing on people's ability to seek care. But I don't have control over it, so our role is to advocate, including with other city agencies.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm going to call this session to a close. I thank you all for your attention. And again, if you have questions or comments, please come forward. Thank you, Drs. Danziger and Bassett.